In this episode, we speak with Dr. Onyeka Nubia, who teaches African history at the University of Nottingham. We speak with Professor Toby Green, who teaches African history at King's College London. And we speak with Dr. Jim Oganiyu, who teaches art history at the University of Lagos. So in this episode, we talk about the arrival of the Europeans in the 15th century, the exchange of ambassadors during this period, trade, ironworks, and small-scale industrialization, and the role of art in these different societies, and spread of religion as well. Enjoy. So now we speak with Dr. Onyeka Nubia, who teaches history at the University of Nottingham.
The whole point of the podcast is to understand the formation of the current world order. And to do that, we have to look at the states that existed before the Europeans arrived and started trading strongly in different commodities. I mean, bear in mind, Europeans have always traded with Africans for millennia. But the arrival in the 16th, 15th century of Portuguese really tilted the narrative because it brought firearms and it changed the direction of trade into other commodities.
There has been continuous and consistent contact between the peoples of the continent of Africa and Europe throughout the whole of human history. And there have been Europeans, of course. The Italians were involved in circumnavigating around the continent of Africa, looking for trade routes with the East. And so,
and looking for Prester John as well.
Certainly looking for Prester John, certainly. And so, in many ways, they were precursors before the Portuguese and the Spanish. But you're right to talk about the Portuguese and the Spanish, and then the others coming thereafter. So it's hard to talk about. Therefore, it's hard to talk about the continent of Africa as before the Europeans arrived, because Europeans had been in constant contact with the continent of Africa. But certainly, African civilizations are a fundamental aspect of the historical narrative of the continent of Africa. And each region had civilizations and cultures. Now, there is a feature that we see from Shaka, and it's the same thing that we see in Back Congo. It's the same thing that we see amongst the emperors of Songhai. It's the same thing that we see in the Mossi. It's the same thing that we see in Ethiopia with Negus. It is the same thing that we see in many parts of the African continent, which is upon their age seniority. That is a common thread, I'm just thinking, in almost every African civilization without exception. Another common thread is that women have a consistent and permanent voice in the running of the society. That is also a given in almost every African civilization that I can think of. I'm just thinking. I can't think of an exception. Okay. So these relationships, these interconnected relationships between inside the African state are bound together by familial ties and familial relationships of extended families. It is the extended family networks, what we might call in European society, cousins, uncles, aunts, and what have you, although people don't use those terms. It is just families. These extended families are the rubric through which local leadership emerges, through the extended families. National leadership and imperial leadership comes about as a result of a need mostly to marshal for war purposes.
So now we hear a recording from Zina Badawi and a paramount chief of the Ashanti Kingdom in present-day Ghana. They talk about the formation of the Ashanti Empire in the 17th century.
Back in the 17th century, King Osei I and his confidant, Okonfo Anokye, they came from Akwamu, somewhere around eastern region in present-day Ghana, and came to Kumasi. When they came here, they fought. They conquered some of the people who were living in here already, and they established themselves as the supremos of this area, King Osei-Tutu and Okonfo-Anokye, decided that they should get a new Sioux that Osei-Tutu will occupy. And Okonfo-Anokye did some magic or some conjure that one nice golden Sioux came from the heavens, and it came to sit on the lap of King Osei-Tutu, and King Osei-Tutu became the Ashanti Hene. We talk about him because he's the one who established the Ashanti Kingdom. He fought many, many wars and conquered many, many areas. So he is the one who actually established the Ashanti Kingdom. We still talk about him. This is the reason why when King Osei-Tutu II took his name, a lot of us thought good things will come out from this man.
The Ashanti Kingdom was quite a militaristic one.
That's
just
right.
Tell us a bit about how it used its very disciplined soldiers to expand its territories.
In the beginning, King Osei-Tutu and Okonfo-Anokye came in here. They conquered a lot of people in here. And then they were able to go to the coast and buy guns. And when they had guns, they thought the only way to use the gun well is to expand and get more lands and get more people to serve them. And so they expanded from the coast all the way from east to west of now modern day Ghana.
So now back to Dr. Onyeka Nubia.
So the Ashanti Hene in the Ashanti culture is responsible for organizing the people for war. So it is a position that is held to maintain order in case of external aggression. A very similar situation applies in Oyo, because Songhai was one of the largest empires geographically in the continent of Africa. It was the size of Western Europe. So I might put that if you don't mind.
That's perfect, yeah.
So Songhai is very interesting in that it is a perfect example in that there are tributary kings. Even Oyo at one point was paying tribute to the Emperor of Songhai. Even the kings of Benin at one point were paying tribute to the Emperor of Songhai. And even the rulers of Mossi paying tribute to the Emperor of Songhai at one point. And of course, the other kingdoms of ancient Ghana, as they became controlled by Songhai, and of course, Timbuktu. So this super state, this super empire, functioned as a consortium in its originality. So originally, the ruler, the Emperor of Songhai, through taxation and through contribution, maintained a relatively loose affiliation of states who respected the fact that the Emperor of Songhai would defend them should there be external aggression from wherever source. If the emperors from the north, the kings from the north would come down, the Emperor of Morocco and others would come down, then Songhai would defend them. Even the previous rulers of Mali relinquished their authority, sometimes by force, but also by compliance with the Emperors of Songhai because of the belief that the Emperor of Songhai will defend them. So the problem arises when the Emperor of Songhai is unable to defend them. So in 1591, the Emperor of Songhai marshals an enormous army, hundreds of thousands of mounted troops and foot soldiers, to meet a combined army of the Prince of Morocco, the Ottoman Emperor, plus English soldiers, mercenaries, and other Europeans also involved. This small army met the Emperor of Songhai's enormous army. And the Emperor of Songhai was absolutely and roundly defeated. Absolutely defeated. And the manner of the defeat is fundamentally important. The Emperor of Songhai decided to have a trick where they attached them. They tried to drive cattle into the Ottoman and European invading army. But because of the weaponry of the Ottomans, the cattle became so startled that they turned and charged back into the ranks of the army of Songhai. So the army of Songhai was broken apart before they even came into contact with the army of Al-Mansur. Al-Mansur was in charge of the Ottoman side, and the Empire of Songhai was so roundly defeated, so absolutely defeated. I believe that this is fundamental in us understanding how and why so many West African states, including Mossi, including Oyo, including the Ashanti, including many others, began to develop relationships with Western Europeans because they needed guns. They needed guns and they needed cannons. And they began to send ambassadors out to various parts of the world, to the Ottoman Empire and to the Europeans, to gain hold of guns and cannons because they had heard how the Emperor and the Empire of Songhai have been so absolutely defeated, so embarrassingly defeated. This, I think, is one of the most major and important factors in the destabilization of Western Africa, and helps to explain why these African leaders, because it was in fact the overtures of the African leaders to the European states that began the process. Not the other way around. It's the overture of the African states to Europeans that began the process. There is a wonderful book on this by David Northrup called Africa's Discovery of Europe, which is a very interesting book about African overtures to discover Europe because they felt that they needed weaponry, and some of them felt that they needed to convert to Christianity and Islam in order to gain hold of the weapons. And sometimes the Ottoman Empire or the Europeans told the African leadership that in order for you to work the weapons, you need to be a Christian, you need to be a Muslim, there's special magic, and the only way it will work is by becoming a Christian and becoming a Muslim. So that's what began the process often in the 16th century. Yes.
That's very interesting. But then also, I mean, we know that Christianity and Islam have been on the continent from the very beginning, you know, from the conversion of people in Arabia and those who left persecution, and also Christians, you know, when Constantine converted all of Rome, and I think Aksum was trading back then with Rome, and he converted to Christianity as well, the king, and many people in Ethiopia converted to Christianity.
The North African churches, led by people like St. Augustine of Hippo,
exactly,
in modern-day Carthage, was the center of the early Christian movement. From the first until the fourth century, what destroyed that civilization was the Vandals and the Visigoths, Germanic peoples who came in from the Iberian Peninsula and invaded those North African civilizations, Romanized North African civilizations, and destroyed that mixture of Romanized, Latin, African, Punic, Coptic religion and culture, which was vibrant and dynamic. It forced those people to go further south. So many of those people went south into what is now Chad, and Mauritania, and actually became the Moorish people of those regions. And others went east into what is now Egypt, and etc. So that's what happened to them. Or they were wiped out, and those that stayed were almost totally wiped out. So that's another feature of history that is rarely spoken
about. That's very interesting. And I'd like you to talk about Islam as well, you know, how it spread in that same way.
Yes. So the interesting thing about Islam, Christianity, and Judaism, all three of the Abrahamic religions, prior to European and Ottoman, prior to Western European and Western European early modern, and prior to Ottoman incursion, all three of these religions are to be found within the continent of Africa.
Definitely.
There is a very strong Jewish population and Jewish tradition in parts of West Africa,
mm-hmm.
parts of West Africa, as well as North Africa and East Africa. Not so strong in Southern Africa, as far as you can tell, but certainly West Africa, North Africa, and East Africa. There is also a strong Islamic tradition which is not East-centered. It's not centered on the East, but following many of the traditions that we associate with Islam, a sort of more African-centered Islamic tradition, which are the practices and philosophy that predominated in many West African civilizations of the 8th, 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th, 13th, 14th, 15th, and 16th century.
Indeed.
In some cases, such as in ancient Ghana, not Ghana, but ancient Ghana.
Yeah, which is more Mauritania today.
Yes, the kingdom, the people, the rulers of ancient Ghana were animistic, but the population were Muslim, Christian, and Jewish.
Yes.
And animist. So the same thing. It was slightly different in Mali. In Mali, the emperors of Mali were nominally Muslim, but they ruled over populations that were Christian, Jewish, Islamic, and animist.
Animist, basically, just for the sake of the listeners, means like indigenous religions.
Indigenous religion, yes. Indigenous traditional African religion.
Exactly.
And their Islam was of a... Then let's use the word. Yeah, let's use it. Multicultural perspective before multiculturalism. Yeah. In the true sense of the word.
I mean, let's pay homage to us all. Yeah, I mean.
Yes. before even the Europeans were using the phrase. So that the emperors of Mali could have a society that was multi-ethnic in the true sense of the word.
Indeed.
Multi-religious, co-religious. And the society could function and develop in all of those different ways, with each person having their own religion. I often say to people that in Mali, a woman could wake up in the morning and read her Quran, and then in the daytime go to the madras and read text, Latinized text from the Bible, and then in the evening time go and sit under her ancestor's tree and pay respect to her ancestors. And she can do all of those three things in one day without worrying about heresy or feeling herself in any way alienated from any of those practices.
Exactly. And such things still actually happen today. I mean, not in Absolutely. That detail, but you have people who are in families where the mom is Christian. In Nigeria, I know. Absolutely. Mom is Christian. In Ghana, dad is Muslim. And it's not an issue at all. And you go to the village and your grandparents still worship the old gods, and you still pay homage as well. And also this would lead to a lot of jihad, because you had people who believed that you had to create a stauncher, role of Islam, and then they had to overthrow the people who felt like, okay, this sort of thing was okay.
The ambassador in the 16th century, the ambassador from Istanbul visited the emperor of Songhai's palace and was absolutely shocked that in this nominally Islamic state, that the emperor's daughters greeted him naked and then sat down to have conversations with him about politics. And he left the emperor of Songhai and wrote in his letter, "Are there any Muslims in Songhai?" In other words, he's saying that they have a completely different way of doing things.
Op-ed, really.
So what he's seeing there is something that he doesn't understand.
Mm-hmm.
These African women have the confidence to walk around how they please. After they bathe, they may get dressed, they may not. That is entirely a matter for them. They no one would have any second thoughts about it. It is absolutely their freedom to do so.
Exactly.
And the reason why they're able to sit down and have conversations about politics is because they are encouraged absolutely to have their own minds and to have views and comments on politics, ideology, and religion. But of course, the ambassadors from Istanbul say that this is not what they are used to. Not what they are used to.
The next question really is also on trade and industrialization. You know, there's this misconception that there was no industrialization on the continent. There was a lot of manufacturing and sale of this manufacturing. But on what basis did trade among, say, a state that produced cloth and also some pieces of iron? How did this, if you could pick one state, for example, and just talk about how they traded and also the level of industrialization in that society?
It is often an idea that Africans didn't produce anything, and the continent of Africa and African history in terms of industrialization only begins with Europeans. For us to understand how the systems worked, we have to understand, if we take a place like Oyo was a center for iron smelting. And it was known as a center for iron smelting for more than 2,000 years. So even as early on as the Romans were often receiving iron that had originated in Oyo and made its way across the Sahara Desert to North Africa, and then from North Africa into Egypt, and then from Egypt across the Mediterranean Sea and into Rome. So the Romans, however, didn't know where their iron came from. They would only hear from the south. So Africans were very, very good in the early stages of ancient civilizations of covering the origin of the places which created the industry.
Exactly.
Very good.
The same with gold and Mali, where they asked, "Where's the gold?" Well, they just knew it was Wangara. They had no
That's
idea
right. That's right.
where the gold was coming from.
And when you read texts, classical, medieval, and early modern European texts, they also say that the African traders told lies to their European counterparts. Told the Europeans, the gold falls from the trees. We just pick it up. We pick it up from the ground. There's a river. There's a river that flows. And this river flows with whatever you need. All these kinds of things, these stories. Or there are people there with two heads. There are people there whose heads do grow beneath their shoulders, you know, the Anthropodai. So there are, and these stories were created, as the English writer Richard Maddox says, to scare Europeans away from going too far south and finding where the centers of industry were.
It's also well.
Finding where, the centers of the trade were, and finding out where the iron reserves were. And, the Africans were very effective at doing this until relatively recently.
The last 500 years or so.
Yeah. Now we speak with Professor Toby Green, who's Professor of African History at King's College London.
Yeah, so Congo was, as I said, an important kingdom until towards the end of the 17th century when it began to decline.
Yes, okay. So how exactly did these powerful states, you know, shape the region and the states around this period?
Well, they controlled the region. I mean, in the same way as states have always, you know, have controlled their territories in any part of the world. I mean, I think, you know, colonialism didn't begin in Africa until the late 19th century or the middle part into the late 19th century. And so at this time, you know, Congo and surrounding states controlled through a combination of trading power, military use, tribute, which they would get from states which weren't as powerful as them or politically powerful as them, marriage alliances, and so on.
Yeah. I was asking in terms of hegemony, like, you know, if they use the same currency, if they, like you said, they controlled the trade route, so of course they probably controlled the flow of money.
Yeah, I think currency was very important. Yes, absolutely. So currency, there were currencies in long-standing use. So if you look at Niger Bend, you had carry currency, certainly by the 13th century. You had copper was an important currency, particularly important in Congo, actually, but also it was important in other parts of Africa. The historian Eugenia Herbert wrote a book called Red Gold of Africa to show how important copper was. Iron was an important currency in West Africa. So, yeah, control of currency was an important part in who could then control trade. And of course, that became very important in the Atlantic era, because as currencies started to become imported through the Atlantic world, you know, the major trading goods, certainly until the 1700s, were not alcohol and guns, but were actually currencies which were in use in different parts of West Africa. So as control of access to those became very important, in which states would rise and fall. Weaving was also very important, and weaving trade was very important. Congo actually, in fact, Congo, one of Congo's major exports by the end of the 16th century, was cloth, which it manufactured itself. Cloth was so important to the Fula, the Fulani, who were across many parts of West Africa, that one of the currencies on the West African coast in Senegambia region was called the Bara Fula, because it was the Fula type of cloth. And in fact, if you read trading books in the early 17th century, which I have done, from the Guinea-Bissau region, you know, the main item traded is actually cloth, and it was woven in different workshops all up and down the coast. So cloth was a very important item of trade, alongside, as you say, minerals and agriculture.
That's really interesting. I didn't know that, actually. Okay, so all these states have become established around this period, 15th, 16th century. You mentioned marriage. That would have been one basis for diplomatic relations. You know, how exactly did they interact with themselves? We know that when diplomacy occurs, the most important thing is divinity. And we know that we had diplomats go from court to court and interact and secure trade routes and things of that nature. So how exactly did these states interact amongst themselves?
Well, I mean, I think the first thing to say is that, you know, that was their interaction, was amongst themselves. You know, some of them had long-distance connections. A few of them, Mali did, Dahomey did later. But by and large, their inter-diplomatic connections were one another. I think religion played a very important part.
That's true.
Of course, it did in other parts of the world. But, you know, for example, we could take a good example would be in Nigeria, the relationship between Benin and Yoruba-speaking areas of Nigeria. So the kings of Benin were confirmed by the Oni of Ife, the religious figurehead of Ife, into the late 16th century, which shows that although Benin was an independent kingdom, its political power, and in some ways you could say, therefore, its religious power was also related to the religious power of figurehead in another part of the same.
Uganda, really.
Yeah, so I think religion was an important part of that, and you could also see that in more perhaps better known areas like Mali, you know, the famous pilgrimage of Mansa Musa through Cairo, where all this gold came, was a part of his pilgrimage to Mecca, so it was part of Islam and Islam's presence in West Africa at that time. So I think religion and religious power and shrines, alongside trade and marriage, were important aspects of that.
Let's talk a bit about the Congo and their relationship with the Portuguese in terms of exchange of ambassadors. You know, you write in your book a bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, Congo had ambassadors in Portugal, it had ambassadors in the Vatican, it had envoys in Brazil, it had envoys at times in the Netherlands also. And that continued actually right through to almost the end of the 17th century. And so, it was a diplomatic player alongside the other diplomatic players, certainly in the Atlantic world. And actually in the early part of the Portuguese interactions with West Africa, other kingdoms also had their ambassadors in Portugal. Benin did. Jolof from Senegambia also did. So this was, you know, quite a common part of diplomatic relations between our various parts of West Africa and certainly Portugal in the 16th century.
Exactly, indeed. And, you know, in Western Africa and West Central Africa in general, how important was art to the makeup of society?
Well, I mean, I think art is always important to the makeup of a society, and I think certainly it expressed it expresses a society's view of itself, really, I would say. And you can certainly see that, for example, with the iconic Benin bronzes. Now, the production of the bronzes increased dramatically in the 16th century, and it had existed beforehand, certainly became much more widespread after the 16th century. And one of the core reasons for that was the increase in the import of copper, actually, from Portuguese. Travellers who visited the palace of the Oba of Benin in the 17th century described floor-to-ceiling bronzes depicting, and they were histories. They were histories of what happened under different rulers and the interactions that they had had. And so that artistic representation was very important, and you can see that in many different, among the many different peoples of West Africa. So, for example, the Viola people of Senegambia developed new masking traditions to represent the different experience which interaction with Atlantic trade brought to society. And so that was very important in terms of identity and representation of self in this period.
Interesting. So we talked about the forging of Africa, modern African states, and the economic basis and diplomatic basis of their existence. So now we're looking at the arrival of the Europeans. What was the initial interaction when Europeans first arrived the coast before the beginning of the slave trade?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, I mean, the Europeans, I mean, it's a bit, in a way, a difficult question to answer. They're different. This really, okay. So the first thing to bear in mind is that most Europeans who arrived didn't last long. They mostly died within 6 months or a year. And those that did survive were often very ill, chronically ill in bed. And in fact, one of the first, responses we have of an African ruler is to, the Portuguese was the king of the ruler in Ghana at what's now Elmina in the 1480s when the Portuguese wanted to build their fortress there. He said, well, you know, most of the Europeans who come to up until now have been dirty. There haven't been many and they've been vile, real as the Portuguese word, vile. So, you know, they weren't very impressed. And I think over time, of course, things changed. Those who did survive often, usually actually intermarried, had families, a Creole class developed. That class became intermediaries between European traders who would arrive and spend time trading slaves and trade routes going inland. And so those relations would change. But to begin with, the very start, when the Portuguese arrived, they, on the Senegambian coast in the 1440s, they simply tried to continue the holy war they had been fighting against Islam in Iberia and North Africa in Senegambia, because of course the Jolof were Muslim, so for them it was an ideological continuity. So they began to try, initially they tried military capture. That didn't work very well because they were overpowered, they were defeated, so then they started trying trade. So that was the beginning. But then alongside that we have these other elements of the fact that they didn't adapt very well to the climate, they died frequently, and then the interactions, the marriages they formed as well, those who stayed, and then the Creole cross which emerged.
Interesting. And then
revert to Islam in part because they thought it might protect them from enslavement. And people also sought to convert to Islam by the end of the 18th century because as part of the struggles which were taking place to end enslavement, because they would then turn on, if they were from an enslaved class within West Africa, they would then be able to attack the property of their former masters. So there were lots of reasons why Islam became more and more powerful by the end of the 18th century, because Christianity really was a late arrival on the scene. It didn't, although, as you say, it was present in Ethiopia and in Eastern Africa very early, it certainly wasn't a powerful force in West Africa until the middle of the 19th century.
Interesting. So let's quickly go down to the colonization process.
So we know that Africa had always been global and retained those global interconnections right the way through this period, 16th, 17th, 18th centuries. At one point in my book, I talk about the ambassadors from the Kingdom of Dahomey going to Brazil, going to Lisbon at the end of the 18th century. So this is a process which continued. I think the other thing I'd like people to be aware of is that diplomatic and political relationship power went alongside a constant process of transformation, of internal transformation according to social, cultural and political norms from within Africa. So I've talked already about transformations of artistic ideas. But there were also transformations of religious ideas. Very importantly, you know, this idea somehow of a kind of unchanging or static world is completely false. You know, African religions transform themselves in the 17th and 18th centuries. New shrines, new relationships, new representations. And then, as we said already, you know, Islam then came along at the end of the 18th century. So these ideas, these cultural forms, were transforming themselves according to new fashions, new religious fashions. But we've also talked about new fashions in clothing, new fashions in jewellery, which were being imported and then being transformed by African weavers. So this is a time not of transformation according to African cultural norms and frameworks within a broader framework of global political interactions. And I think that is an important starting point really for understanding that historical process. Then, of course, we have the way in which the unequal exchanges, which were part of the, first of all, of course, the transatlantic slave trade, secondly, the economic structure which underpinned that was also creating a framework which, although Africans retained political power, although they retained cultural power, that was slowly being undermined by broader global forces. So that's the kind of, if you like, almost like a sort of system of Russian dolls, one in another, which somehow hopefully would help listeners to understand the interaction of all these complex forces.
Babushkas. That's actually very interesting. And then, in your view, what would you say are the legacies of what we've talked about so far?
I think one of the legacies, as I've mentioned, the late 18th century, early 19th century was a time of revolutions in West Africa, overthrow of aristocratic power, which then, I think, very importantly, as I've said, didn't really, in a way, have time to really bed down before the aftermath of those revolutions, didn't really have time to settle before the colonial process began. I think that's important because I think one of the legacies is a distrust in many parts of Africa, perhaps of state power. You can see that in many forms today, actually, on the continent today, distrust of elites, and the way in which power is manipulated by them. I mean, I'm not sure. Of course, as time goes on, one might say, you know, this is more and more just the same in any part of the world, which is also true. But I think state power certainly had, especially because it then segued into colonial state power, that mistrust of the state, I think, is an important legacy, actually. And that's an important legacy for policymakers too, because most policymakers in the world start from the framework of the beneficent state, because that's what they have generally been brought up with and educated with. So understanding that that is not everybody's framework and not everybody's historical experience, I think is an important.
So now we hear a recording done between Kate Meinel and Professor John Picton on Ife Art and the remarkable lost wax casting technique.
That it represents an African civilization at the height of its powers between the 11th and 15th century, of which almost nothing was known about to the world beyond until the discovery of the works of art. A good deal of Ife art has been found by accident. In the dry season of 38-39, they were digging out the foundations for a house in the area behind the king's palace, and they found 17 cast brass heads and a half figure. And at that point, the king of Ife himself said, well, I've got two of these in my palace. And he produced a terracotta, the Lajua head, which is in the show, and the mask of Obalufon, an early king of Ife. And the person who is credited with introducing brass casting to Ife.
This is made by a process known as hollow lost wax casting. In that, the first stage is to make a core of clay that will occupy the space inside. When that has been done and moulded, what one does then is coat it with wax. So put on wax to the thickness that you require. Then what the next stage is to actually do the important bit, the artwork. In other words, to carve the wax to the face. At this stage, you then add pouring channels down which the metal will flow, and you have some other channels, once again in wax. The next stage then is to actually apply the very fine clay very carefully to the outside, to the thing, to create a negative mold. The next stage then is to invert it and put it in the furnace so that the wax can run out. So you've now got a hollow space where the wax was. You then put that at a higher temperature and run in the molten brass and let the whole thing cool down, take away the mold casing, and there is your head.
The overwhelming visual quality of those heads is their naturalism, an idealized naturalism. In other words, Ife has made us expand our view.
So now we speak with Dr. Jim Oganiyu, who teaches art history at the University of Lagos.
They are beautiful, but more of the functionality. And they are also connected to not just the physical realm that we could actually relate with. They are also connected with the spiritual realm. They are also connected. It's like a kind of totality of human existence. So, and that is part of the reasons why, when the Europeans, when they saw most of the traditional African artworks and they brought in, archaeologists to actually talk about these things, they removed the context, of context of productions, context of, use of those artworks. And they just said that, these African artists, when they were producing this, they lack, the concept of proportion, because most African artworks usually have big heads, and smaller body. So sometimes they could actually have, I'm talking about traditional sculptural works, they could also have protruding, navel. So, but unknown to them, these things were intentionally, created like that, because you cannot, like I said, you cannot actually divorce these works from the worldview, the cosmology of African beliefs. So, and that is why the African artist that made the head to be bigger than body is actually connecting that particular piece to the African worldview, because the head is the seat of knowledge, the seat of destiny. So, and there are so many proverbs, there are so many sayings, that are attributed to that, anything you want to be, anything you want to do in life, you have the inner head and you have the outer head. So this is actually being translated into the artistic works. And you can see that the works are not just there, to adorn a particular place, to adorn the shelf of the museum. They are there to perform a particular purpose, which is usually communal. Some of them, you know, like all those traditional African war, I mean, sculptural pieces, costumes and all that, they were made to be used as objects of performance. So now, a kind of European archaeologist or art historian that is appreciating that particular work from the context of aesthetics will never get the total understanding of that particular art, because those works, you know, were not made to be appreciated behind shelves, behind glasses. You know, they were produced to be part of, you know, performative art, which is very, very significant in African, you know, worldview. Then I also talked about sometimes, you know, like in Akwanshi, you know, Cross River of Nigeria, we usually have these sculptural pieces that have protruding navel. It is, if you want to appreciate or critique African art from that angle, you know, it may be difficult. But from the African context, it is the kind of connection between the child, the unborn child, and the mother. It is through the umbilical cord, which is connected to the navel. So by producing an artwork that has a kind of protruding navel, you know, the artist is actually, you know, situating it within the context of, you know, creation, of creativity, and having a kind of touch with the past, even though it is in the present, and also with the world of the unborn, which is the child. You know, so those are the things, you know, African arts, you know, they are actually a kind of embodiment of, you know, total African existence. So, and that is very, very important, you know, for historians to understand, and for, you know, archaeologists, you know, especially to understand that. Then apart from, you know, serving that kind of, you know, the purpose, apart from, you know, being an embodiment of the spiritual entity and all that, African arts are also there, you know, to provoke discourse on socio-political issues. It is not actually a contemporary thing. It has been there since, you know. And when I talk about art, I'm actually talking about the total art. You know, we have the music, we have the performance, and we have the visual art. You know, in traditional sense, you know, we had the performance of all these masquerades, you know, that were there. So masquerades were there, you know, as spirits of the ancestors, you know, to, if you want to, you know, if something is wrong in the society, you can actually consult the spirit of the ancestors through the masquerades, you know, and the masquerades are like, they are like the links, you know, between the world of the living and the world of, you know, of the ancestors, you know, and that is why, you know, everybody actually revere them, respect them, because it's like the ancestors are actually part of existence. So definitely, you know, they make sure everything actually go well. So, and in this traditional sense, you know, these masquerades were also there for social control and social justice. You know, we have argued it, you know, sometimes in a conference, you know, and somebody actually said that it is not possible. Masquerades cannot actually arrest a king. Masquerades in African sense had the power to actually arrest a king. So, and yes, it even happened in old Oyo Empire. Yeah, it happened. You know, in old Oyo Empire, you know, there was this king that was, you know, became a despot. They called him Obajayi, became despot and all that. And there was a particular, the masquerade did not reside in that particular town. It was in another town entirely. And the masquerade was coming to the market, to Akeson market. And the Oba knew that if the masquerade reached the market, would just be talking about the atrocities that the Oba had actually committed. He was going to bring it open, you know, so because the Oba cannot, you know, arrest the masquerade in a market square, because being a market square has its own spiritual entity. You know, there are so many routes that lead to the market. The market is like, you know, the abode of the murders, you know, of the witches, of, you know, things like that. So exactly. And it's a place where people converge. You know, people converge for so many things. Even if the Oba wants to tell the community something, he will have to go to them. He will send messenger to the market square to tell them about this. So the masquerade spell is, you know, somehow spiritual in its own sense. So the particular Oba in question, you know, actually committed suicide because he knew that that particular masquerade was going to, you know, divulge the secret. So that is a kind of, you know, expressions that we had, you know, in African traditional artistic practices sense, you know, and which also served as, you know, something like social control, something to provoke discourse. Also in this southwestern Yoruba part, we had the Efe, you know, the Efe and the Egungun and all that. Those ones there, I mean, those ones too, they were there, you know, to serve as, you know, social control through satire. You know, they talk about the hills in the society. And the Oba can't do anything about them, can't arrest them. So that is what we had, you know, in that particular period of time. You know, and not to also, you know, to also talk about music, you know, we had different kind of music, you know, that expresses the socio-political issues in the society. So then coming to the contemporary times, actually we cannot easily separate the contemporary from the tradition. You know, there is transition, you know, and even in the contemporary, yes, we still have, you know, part of the tradition in the contemporary, you know, contrary to what some people believe, you know, that, oh, especially, you know, the European writers and all that, African traditional art stopped during colonialism and something else started. No, it is never like that. You know, there is a kind of transition. There is a kind of morphology, you know, through which the contemporary actually, came to be. So, and, in the contemporary as well, you know, artistic, productions in African sense shifted some bases, actually, you know, because when it was in the traditional sense, it was communal. Like I said, you know, it was communal. Like in the Benin Empire, for example, the Oba was actually in charge of the Guild of Bronze Casters, you know, in charge of, you know, the ivory carvers and all that, you know. Oba was the major patron of that particular, you know, and the artists were not actually signing their works individually, you know, because they believed that it was done for the common, you know, good of the society. So, but in the contemporary period, you know, it kind of things shifted, you know, the infusion of, you know, Western ideals, you know, religion and things like that, you know, all those things influence the contemporary art, and it makes it a kind of bricolage of, you know, the tradition and the contemporary ideals. So, and then we started having artists, you know, signing their works personally. You know, that has actually personalized artistic expressions, you know, artistic practices, because this thing is not generally for the common good. Again, it's like, oh, this is my work, then I can sell this work, I can do this, I can do that. And it's also affected the kind of theme that they address in the society. You know, now most of their themes were being controlled by patronage. You understand what I mean? So, you know, so, but nevertheless, we still have, you know, a quite, you know, large number of artists, you know, even in the contemporary sense, that address socio-political issues, you know, be it in visual art, in music, in theater. We have a lot of, and one very important thing or significant thing that happened in Nigerian, experience is during colonialism, you know, we had Dr. Nnamdi Azikiwe, who actually, you know, created one of the first indigenous newspapers in Nigeria, the West African Pilot, you know. So, and because he knew the importance of visual expressions, you know, to be used as propaganda. So Dr. Nnamdi Azikiwe, you know, employed Akinyolala Shekan, who happens to be the first cartoonist, political cartoonist in Nigeria. So he employed Akinyolala Shekan, you know, to visualize his ideals about socio-political, about colonialism. So, and in the West African Pilot newspaper, Akinyolala Shekan expressed a lot of counter narratives, you know, that actually disturbed the European government at that particular time. There are lots of cartoons, you know, that were published in the West African Pilot, you know, that criticized colonialism generally, you know, a lot of that. So, you know, that was one of the first time when visual arts, you know, in the contemporary sense, actually, you know, was actually used as object of socio-political, you know, expressions, you know. So then also the likes of Hubert Ogunde, you know, also used their theatrical performances, you know, to talk about the hills in the, you know, in the First Republican era in Nigeria. the likes of the likes of Chinua Achebe. You know, Chinua Achebe is someone that believes that art should actually serve the purpose, should serve socio-political realistic purpose of expressing, art should actually express the issues in socio-political milieu. In fact, in the last book that he published, There Was a Country, he actually said that, if the society is ill, the artist has the obligation to point it out. The artist is the one, that is actually in charge, to point it out, to actually show the people and show, to talk truth to power. So, and we can see, a lot of, books he wrote, especially before the first coup in Nigeria, a lot of them were like, a kind of predictions of what was going to, happen in the country. So, and also the likes of Fela Anikulapo Kuti, use this music, to talk about socio-political issues, to provoke discourse on so many things in the society. So, so contemporary art, is playing significant role, in Nigeria, in Africa generally, because it's unfortunate that, the type of leadership, Africa, has today, they don't really actually have, the love of the masses at heart. So, and at the same time, they are, even though they claim to be democratic, they are actually dictatorial. A great example is what is happening in Nigeria now, They are, very, very dictatorial. And because of the fact that the masses, are usually afraid, to talk about certain things because of the fear of persecution, the fear of, the secret services and all that, in Nigeria, for example, you have freedom of expression, but you don't have freedom after expression. That is the last cartoon I did. You don't have freedom after expression. So, and we are in a democracy. So, the masses actually rely on artists, to actually, to couch these socio-political issues within visual symbolism, that in a kind of satirical form, that in a way, you look at this thing, you laugh at it, but at the same time, still passing that kind of message, and because of the fact that to a very large extent, the artists still have this, poetic license, if I can put it that way, because, it is visual image. We can actually use different type of symbolism, even though the person knows that, you are talking to me, you are making mockery of me, but the person may find it difficult to pin you down. It may be difficult for, the person to actually win you in a court of law because you've actually used symbolism. You didn't write the person's name there. You didn't do this, you didn't do that. So contemporary African masses actually rely on the artist, to bring this thing to the fore, to bring this thing out, to talk about, all these socio-political realities. And as an activist and an artist as well, I believe that art shouldn't actually be for aesthetics alone. Art shouldn't just adorn our walls alone. Art should play a significant role of, critical intervention in, in socio-political discourse in the society. There is this Pakistani artist, I think he died in 2008 or so, if I'm not mistaken, Nagori. Nagori actually states that in art, there are so many artists that are occupied with solving the problem of aesthetics, But also, there are quite a number of artists that are preoccupied with using aesthetic elements to solve socio-political issues. And he believes that the artists that use aesthetic elements to solve socio-political issues are the ones that are taking artistic obligations in the society. Do you understand? Yeah, because that is actually the essence of art in the society. To provoke discourse, to bring attention to so many other things. Because if you look at it, journalists can write a lot of things in 3 pages, 4 pages. People may not read it. But look at what is happening today. Look at look at cartoons, look at some paintings that address socio-political issues and all that. So, and also something, there's also a very important, development that is happening now with the coming of internet, social media and all that. And that is the internet meme. Internet meme is actually bringing a lot of things, bringing a lot of, activism in the younger ones, especially in Africa, bringing a lot of things, because internet memes is, you know, you can use images of these so-called, you know, political actors. You know, you had something to hate, you express yourself. And it is difficult to attach that a particular meme to somebody. You don't know the creator. Because as these memes move, they are being, you know, it's like you are, it is organic. They are changing in forms. You know, people are adding other things. They are removing something they are adding. So at the end of the day, you know, it's actually getting to the political class. It's getting to the, you know, the people in power. And it's a modern form of, you know, talking truth or saying truth to power. You know, and that's really, really helped in this, in the Nigerian NSAS, you know, protest. You know, if not for the social media, you know, a lot of the government is ready, you know, to even tell us that what we can see in real life now is for sure. What we can see, you know, it's appalling. You understand? So, you know.
Indeed, it's so true.
It's serious. So, you know, thank God for social media, you know, that's actually making this. I'm not saying that there is no, you know, fake news on social media and all that. But at the same time, social media is actually giving a lot of people the voice, you know, to talk about issues that affect them. You know, and especially in the visual art form, we have a lot of short comedies, you know, short skits on social media that people are putting out there, you know, to criticize ills, anomalies in the society, at least to express their feelings. And apart from this getting to the government, it's also a form of, it's also therapeutic. You know, it's therapeutic in the sense that, you know, they are expressing their feelings, they are expressing their anger in that kind of form, you know, it will prevent them from, you know, going, how would I put it? Because, you know, a lot of things in this country can actually make someone suicidal, you know. So, but having that kind of platform, you know, to express yourself. So, the social media is actually a game changer. You know, you hold this, and artists, contemporary artists are making great use of that, you know. Then another thing I want to talk about social media is that, I'm doing a research, you know, in trying to relate, the market square in traditional sense with the contemporary social media. So, and I see, yes, exactly. So, and I see it has a lot of relationship, you know. It is, you know, the market square. Yeah, you know, so in order to get a particular, statement, you know, in order to get the kind of, how will I put it, appeals, societal appeal, you know, it has, in the traditional sense, it has to go to the market square, you know, for the mothers, you know, quote unquote, to have, to, you know, to authorize it, you know, because the market square in traditional sense is not just an ordinary space, you know, it's not just an ordinary space, you know, so now, translating that to the social media now. Social media too is like the market square. The market square, anybody can go to the market square. You can go, you come, you go, you come. There's nothing that can, no rule can prevent you except in a state of war that can prevent you from going to the market square to hear your voice. And that is social media. And that is why the government is trying a lot to shut the social media, because they know that it's so powerful. So powerful that the hills, you know, there are so many things that you know, the people can actually express in the social media. So
exactly. Let me just add one or two things here. You know, if you were, for economists say, if you're trying to understand the temperature of the economy, you check the stock market. The stock market will give you what is really going on. In Nigerian case, I'm not so sure, because you know, many of the major players are in the informal economy. That's just how it is. It's the same thing with social media. If you're trying to take the temperature, the mood of the country, you know, you can check the social media. But other people will say, again, you're not so sure, because how many people actually have access to that social media? So this is actually so interesting to me. I'm very glad to hear that. Yeah, and it's really, really true. Because back then, the market was the central focal point for engagement and understanding in all societies. You know, in Igbo culture, for example, the days were market days. You know, all the 4 days were market days.
Exactly. So, do you want to ask me other
questions? Yes, actually. So, the question I wanted to ask is about the picking of materials. So, back then in the olden days, you know, you had like, we talked about the bronze casters in Benin Empire. You talked about, in Oyo, for example, they used a certain kind of lost wax method.
Yeah, so yes,
yeah. Exactly. And in the Nok culture, they use them terracotta.
Yeah.
How and why did they pick certain materials? Is it because of being close to the earth? Is there a reason why? Is there any spiritual or historical or significant reason for picking any of these materials to build sculptures and things like that?
Okay, thanks so much. Yeah. There is something that cannot be ruled out, you know, from artists, you know, picking materials. And that is the nearness to that source of material. You know, that is the first thing. So, and we discovered that, you know, in most part of Africa where we have different, you know, artistic forms in different parts of Africa. And we discovered that most of the time, the materials that are in abundance in a particular region becomes the major, you know, material that they use for the artistic practices. So, and that is why if you look at some, you know, places in Africa, we have more of wood sculptural, you know, works, you know, works that they used wood for, you know, and that might have even predated the Nok culture, you know, but because wood, you know, has a lifespan, you know, you understand what I mean?
It's finite, exactly.
Exactly. So then it is also possible that like Nok culture, for example, of course, you know, they are very close to that source of that particular clay that they were using, you know, at that particular period in time. But at the same time, there is also a kind of, you know, spiritual connection to these materials. Because even though, I mean, we can talk about, okay, they are close to wood, and a particular region is close to wood. That is why, you know, their works are predominantly wood. But at the same time, they've actually, you know, categorized these woods. There are male woods, there are female woods. You know, there's a particular kind of work, you know, that you want to do that you don't use the female wood for. There's a particular one you want to do that you will use the male wood for. So, you know, they've, you know, like I said, you know, they didn't just do things haphazardly. You know, and I know that is even, you are aware of that as well. That's why you really want to know if, you know, those materials, you know, they have, you know, spiritual reasons and all. I would say yes, you know. First is that, you know, the source the nearness to the source of material. The second is that they have actually attributed their worldview, you know, things from their worldview, their cosmology, the spiritual, you know, the philosophy to this particular wood. I mean, or this particular, material. For instance, we've seen cultures whereby they use bronze, they use ivory, and they use clay. You know, in Ife arts, for example, you know, there are some works that, you know, you could see that, oh, these ones are bronze cast, and these ones are, you know, wood and, you know, and clay, for example, or terracotta. So then, even though they might have metamorphosed, you know, from, okay, they were using wood before, they discovered that, okay, wood was not that, you know, it's, there's a, you know, with time, wood will get decayed and all that. Then later, maybe they were using clay, and later when they discovered the technique of Siripaju, okay, they are using bronze. We also discovered that there are some class of people in the society that bronze were not actually used for. The slaves. You know?
That's true.
Yeah, exactly. So they use bronze for the royalty because the best should actually go to the royalty. You know, and they use, you know, clay and, you know, terracotta and all that, you know, for the slaves and, you know, things like that. We also see example of that in Egyptian, you know, arts too. So, you know, there are spiritual, you know, connotations to that.
That's good. Connotations, yeah. That's interesting to me. I mean, even the evolution of tribal marks was done to distinguish people from the slaves in society. That's why people take great pride in having tribal marks throughout history.
You are right. Exactly.
But the question I want to ask next is, you know, you mentioned the Guild of Bronze Casters. In places like Senegal today, we have what we call griots, you know, people who tell stories and histories of their people. But you're born into it. Your father was a griot, most likely you'd be a griot, and your son would be a griot. And, you know, that has been going for the last 1,000 years, present day Mali. But how do you get, how are people gotten as artists? Like, how do you know? Is this like you give birth to a child, you say, okay, this person has talent, or it's deemed by the chief priest, or how exactly did artists, you know, come about? That's what I'm asking in the olden days.
Okay, well, thanks so much, like I said, everything in traditional African existence revolved around their cosmology and the philosophy, the worldview. So, and most times when a child, was born, it was important to consult the oracle. They really need to know, okay, this particular child, what is going to be his destiny? And how do we prevent him from the evil eyes and, things like that? So, and most of the time, the oracle would tell them that this person is going to be doing this, is going to be doing this, is going to, for example, there's a very good, example towards that from the family of, woodcarvers in Osi, in southwestern Nigeria. That is the Fake, the Fakeye family and all that, So now, it is expected that when a child is born into the woodcarver's family, it is expected for the child to actually be a woodcarver as well. But most times we usually have, some exemptions that, okay, the oracle may say, this person is going to be this and not what we've expected. We've seen cases like that. I'm a prince from Osun State, Ejibu, and when my grandfather was given birth, the oracle, when he consulted the oracle, and his father was this traditionalist, herbalist and all that. And funny enough, the oracle told them that this child is going to be a Muslim. Can you imagine that? Which pastor will say today that the child is going to be a herbalist? Or which man will say, Alfredo, your child is going to be a herbalist? But the oracle said this one is not going to, join you. In doing your religion, this one is going to be a Muslim. There's also a case of one of the Oba of Lagos, that is Oba Olusi, the Oba Olusi. So when the Oba was actually given birth to and they consulted the oracle told them categorically that this one is going to be an Afa, it's going to be an Imam. And it was the oracle that said that, that is to tell you how great our traditional religion, is. You understand what I mean? Yeah, exactly.
And truthful.
Truthful. So, so it is not, uncommon, for the oracle to have said that, this person will, continue in the father's lineage and all that. And, also, they take pride, the family also take pride in the children, continuing in that kind of, in the father's profession. Because they believe that the secret of that profession will be kept in the family. That is one thing, And that is why, there was a time I was also arguing with a feminist and all that, and we're talking about, why is it that in that traditional African society, the female were prevented from doing the particular whatever. For example, in Benin Kingdom, the female were prevented from casting in bronze. So it was a taboo and all that, the first female to have done that happens to be the daughter of King Akinzwa. So, and the daughter happens to be my PhD supervisor's mother. So that is how, we got to know about, the daughter is a professor now and all that. So, but what I want to point out is that because they knew that the bronze casting guild is a secret, that has to be maintained. And don't forget that art in the traditional sense was so powerful to the level that even you can use art as an object. You can send art and, an artistic object to another town to serve as a symbol.
Mm-hmm.
As you are coming to that place and what is actually embedded in that object can be interpreted to bring war or peace. So art, is very, very powerful, in the society. And artists were so revered. They believed that, these people, they were not just, ordinary person and all that. So now, They believe that if these secrets, you know, were being divulged to the female, they may marry into the enemy's family. Yes, because the female will go. Only the male will remain in the family. So it's not something that is totally bad like that. It's not something that is, you know. That
there's a reason for it.
Exactly. There's a reason for it, you know, and the reason, you know, is also, you know, it's also important. So, you know, so let me round off, you know, to go back to your question, you know.
Oracles
are usually consulted, and also, you know, they believe that, I mean, you know, to keep the secret of the trade, you know, it has to, you know, a father may have a favorite son, you know, and be like, ah, I want everything about this profession is you that I want you to actually, you know, be the one that will carry on this tradition.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah, yeah. They can also force, you know, someone to do that as well. Yeah.
Interesting. So the next question I want to ask now is about the infusion of modern influences, if I can use that phrase. So religion, and also different political environments, you know, with the coming of the Europeans, the Obas became like basically stooges for Europeans to do and undo from behind the scenes. And also you had the coming of modern religions like Christianity and Islam. You know, Islam, for example, you know, is prohibited to draw human beings are figures. You're more likely to use symbols and things like that. And around this period, society was changing quite quickly. So the period is actually quite fragmented. So I'm asking two questions here, basically. So the first question is, how conversant were people with the art of different societies? So did the people in Benin know about the art in the Oyo? You know, I know Oba of Benin and Oba of Lagos were very, basically, Lagos was a tributary of Benin, and they paid tributes to Benin, which is why when the British first came to conquer Lagos, they asked the Oba to come and negotiate with them. He said, no, you cannot negotiate because his Oga at the top is in Benin, so please go and negotiate with that person. And then they destroyed Lagos State. And that's the first question. Did they know about themselves? Did they know about what was going on in different societies? And then secondly, with the coming of Europeans and modern religion, how did that now influence the art that was being created in pre-colonial Africa?
Okay, thanks so much for that question. Yeah, the first one is, you know, they actually knew about artistic practices of other communities. You know, like the Benins, you know, the Benins, still have a very strong link with the Ifes. You know, yes, exactly. So even though we may have disparities in the stories, but there's no, the Yorubas, you know, they don't actually argue that there's a connection between Ife and Benin. And the Benins too don't argue that there's a connection. But, exactly. But the manner of the connection is what is actually being, you know, argued, you know, on top and all that. So now, in fact, even from talking from artistic angle, we could actually see a very great, you know, connection, like umbilical cord between the Ife art and the Benin art. Ife art predates Benin art, you know. So, and we can actually see the kind of, you know, progression. Even though Ife art, you know, is more naturalistic, you know, more realistic, you know, like humans. And
mm-hmm.
Benin art must have, you know, developed, must have actually broken from that shackles of, oh, let it look so real like human. You know, they've tried as much as possible to, you know, to have a kind of abstract or stylized expressions, you know, in order to just break away from, you know, from where they were actually coming from. But the connection is still there. Then at the same time, there is a particular town between Ife. Geographically, the town is situated almost, you know, midway between Ife and Benin. And that is Owo. You know, and if you look at Owo art, you will see, you know, features of Benin art and features of Ife art.
Mm.
Yeah, so, and in fact, in art history, we refer our art as the melting pot of Benin art and Ife art. So that is to actually tell us that there is, you know, a kind of, movement between Ife and Benin, and Owo must have been a kind of, resting place, or where they had stopovers there and all that, which influenced the culture in Owo at that particular time. So, and also, you see, Frank Willett, one of the, European archaeologists, actually wrote something, in terms of the connection of the Nok culture and the Ife art. He actually studied some forms in Nok culture, and relates that to the Ife art, that maybe, it's like the same set of people, or maybe, maybe they actually moved, migrated over time, and Ife artistic expression in bronze must have been a kind of, upgraded artistic expressions of the Nok culture. Was trying to, because we could see some signs and symbols, in Ife art that are actually related to the Nok culture and, and so on and so forth. But of course, Nok culture predates all those, arts, in Africa. So in a nutshell, we could see connections, from the artistic expression that, that are available. We could see that these people, in a way, were relating. And also, don't forget that there was this, trade routes, in most parts of Africa, trade even with the Arabians, even with the Europeans, before colonialism. The Benins, had been trading with the Portuguese before colonialism.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. So it was not actually just the colonialism, that brought a kind of change like that, exactly. Trade also brought, a lot of things,
Firearms.
Exactly, firearms, they must have been exchanging a lot of things, And if you look at the symbol of the first Act 77, the Queen Idia head, that popular, face, Queen Idia head, you see that if you look at all those, images, sorry, hold on, I think I have a small, this object, that's a replica. If you look at these objects, that are here, if you look closely, this is just a kind of artistic expression.
Mm-hmm.
You see that some objects that were, carved out of this are not actually Africans. And historians have said that they are like the representations, of the Portuguese. We have a lot of Portuguese soldiers being represented in Benin artistic forms.
Yes,
a lot of them, And that's to tell you that, there were links, there were trade, they were actually communicating, with one another and all that. And, when colonialism came, they tried to, you understand what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Things like that, yeah. So then going back to,
second question. Exactly.
Yeah. Religion, yeah. So religion played a significant role, in artistic expression, in the manner in which contemporary arts, are being expressed. And that starts, let's start from colonialism. It's unfortunate that when religion, came initially, a lot of artistic legacies were destroyed. A lot, because that was actually part of the plan, because Africans Africans are known to be religious. And one of the best way to actually, to win them is to first get their religion and give them another religion they don't even understand. Then later, you just call, I'm sorry if you're a religion
person. No, I'm not. It's fine.
Don't mind me.
A lot of things were destroyed at being fetish.
Exactly. Exactly.
A lot of sculptures, a lot of cosmology, a lot of philosophy was just wiped away.
Philosophy, exactly. So, a lot of things. So, and by doing that, even, the culture, even the way of life, the first thought of Africans, that became, that we're trying to be more westernized than the West, they looked down on their people's, culture. They looked down on so many things. Some even, you know, denounced, you know, their appearance, their origin. There are some even changed their names, you know. I see, it's so appalling, you know. I still have, you know, somebody today, the person is bearing a wool lower, and the person changed it to Jesu lower. I was just like, are you serious? You know, so believing that it's that name that is the source of their problem, because the name is connected to, you know, you to fetish things and things like, you know, that is colonial hangover, you know, that is part of, you know, yeah, you know, that's
it's
part
true.
Of, but yeah, yeah, you know, so in artistic sense, a lot of things were destroyed, a lot of things, you know, a lot of traditionalists were, you know, just like what happened in the medieval, you know, age, you know, a lot of traditionalists were, you know, killed, destroyed, and, you know, things like that. Then later, some Africans that, you know, traveled again, that went abroad, mingled with the white, you know, and when they returned, you know, they were ironically, you know, they were the ones that were like, no, this our tradition, you know, is actually one of the best. You know, the likes of Senghor, you know, Leopold Senghor, the likes, you know, a lot of people, you know, from Africa, you know, Wole Soyinka, Fela Kuti, and all of them, you know, they now saw that, oh, these people were actually using this religion as a weapon, you know, of, you know, to, or as a tool of hegemony to actually control us. And things like that. So, and that happened in the heart as well. You know, in the colonial period, when they tried as much as possible to also change their world, there was a workshop that the Roman Catholic Church, you know, sponsored in Oye Ekiti in Osun State. And the workshop was to actually, you know, appropriate traditional African sculptural works. To appropriate them in Western sense, in the, so as to serve religious purpose, to serve Western religious purpose. So, you know, it was a workshop, you know, headed by Father Carol and Mahoney, I'm sure Father Carol very well, you know. So, and the workshop, you know, they got the traditional carvers. Those people that were actually carving, you know, ritual objects, carving for the traditional religion, you know, they got them together. You know, and they trained them on Western style. They didn't affect their style like that.
Mm.
But at the same time, they gave them the themes to address. Then that was when you now see the theme of nativity. You know, Christ and Mary, you know, and the three wise men being actually carved in traditional African style. You know, so that just like what Emperor, you know, Constantine did in trying to situate the date of Christmas, you know, with that particular festival, you know, of a pagan, you know, festival and all that, you know, so that by doing that, they believe that the people will relate more to this particular object, but this object is not serving the quote and unquote the old religion, you know, serving the real religion. You understand? So they try to work on their psyche with that, you know, and from that particular workshop onward, you know, the artists, the sculptors that were involved also started, you know, producing those works, you know, to serve as objects of religious objects, you know, this, that, instead of using that object to serve the traditional, you know, they shifted the patronage, you know, and in a way, they also, you know, they too also got a lot of apprentices and all that. And the style started, you know, there are lots of books, you know.
Interesting.
Africanizing Christian art, you know, by, you know, Nicholas J. Bridger, you know, there are lots of, you know, books about that. So, but, you know, so religion actually plays a significant role because it attempted to actually stop, to halt our traditional artistic practices. So, it was not that easy to just change it drastically. You know, that was why they, you know, they created that kind of workshop, you know, and later after colonialism, you know, our artists also started, you know, expressing in, using Western techniques and Western materials, you know, but they reverted, you know, coming from the, you know, having imbibed the philosophy of, you know, negritude, you know, and so on and so forth, in African Renaissance, African Revival, you know, and things like that. So the artists the contemporary artists now, even though it was difficult for them to go back to the traditional sense, you know, together, because they must have lost touch, they must have lost a lot of things, but they are expressing traditional ideals using Western elements. Do you understand? Yeah, exactly. They are using that, you know, so, and that has actually become, you know, the contemporary art, you know, because in the contemporary, you can't divorce the tradition. That's always been my argument. You know, if you look at it, you see the elements of, you know, of tradition. That is why the likes of Fela and Nkulapo Kuti, you know, if you listen to his songs, you know, you see that, well, it's using, what's it called, Western instruments. But if you listen to his lyrics, if you listen to a lot of things there, you know that, oh, this person, you know, has background in traditional African, you know, context and things like that. You know, so religion tried to wipe it out, but it did not wipe it. It just changed